out of Iraq now.
Hello and welcome to Street Stories. I'm Nadia Stani. If you've been watching the news lately, you'd notice that Islam is often an aspect of the lead story. But Muslim women are either absent from this coverage or seen only as victims of racism and sexism. Today we'll meet three women who've been on a personal journey of liberation, each of them challenging mainstream Islam and the place of women in it.
1 kilo, man.
How much is the kilo, is that?
I'm just wondering if it's all right if I can record some sound here.
Madam, you can record anything you want.
Oh, okay.
Not a problem at all.
All right.
Mate, anybody who wants to make fun, I'm here to listen and laugh with them. Not a problem.
My name is Nazifa. I have been living in Australia for about 20 years. And I come from Turkey. I'm married. I have 2 children.
Nazifa lives in the Melbourne suburb of Dallas, where a large Turkish community has settled. And she's been active with the Alevi community over the last 12 years. The Alevis are a Turkish Muslim denomination whose beliefs centre on humanism and individual responsibility to the divine. Nazifa's journey began a few years ago when she was working in factories.
I worked more than 10 years in the factory, but not just one factory. I worked a couple of different factories. My last employment was in Cumberfield. We worked there 6 years with my husband. My employment is working as, like, you know, Salvation Army, like people who donate their clothes and house items and things like that. So we sort those things in that factory. I learned a lot from that factory. The work, what we did, is very dangerous and also very dirty, because most of the time, is it possible to find injection, like, you know, people using drug and things like that. They just throw in there, and dust, dirty and things like that. The job is terrible, you know. Plus, our boss is more terrible than job, because she's so aggressive person. She didn't know what to do. For example, in one day, I remember we had 2, 3, 4 meeting with her about changing the job system, you know. This minute she said, you have to put T-shirt separate, men's shirt separate, shorts separate, or things like that. In a couple of minutes later, she can put together. She's not saying in normal way when she's explaining these things. I had such a terrible time in that factory, and also I have had learned a lot from that factory. Like, who is the labor, who is the workers, who is the boss, what is the power. In that company, I learned that money is the power. I'm not saying I shouldn't work there. If I wouldn't work there, maybe I wouldn't find myself in this step.
And you think that's what gave you the opportunity to get to where you are now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you want to accept everything, what your husband say, what your children say, what your boss say, what your government say, you deserve everything, you know? You just stay there. If you're saying that, hey, stop, I am a different person, I can't accept whatever you want to, you're going to become a different person.
My name is Suzanne. I come from Somalia, and I was born in Mogadishu, and I was born in 1981. And I live now in Melbourne. I come in 2002.
Suzanne arrived in Australia from Somalia after spending 11 years in virtual servitude following the death of her family in the Civil War. After gathering some firewood one morning, she returned home to find a bomb had hit her family's house. She was 9 and the only survivor.
That day, it was the bad day. You know, I don't want to remember because my mother and my father and my younger brother, that day, they died. 1991. That day, my mom sent me to get a fire. It was in the morning. The time I got the fire, I come back in my home. My home already is destroying because the bomb is clapping everywhere. My father and my younger brother, they didn't get up that day. They sleep. And only my mom and me. My mom, the day I left my mom, she's sitting near the door. Only I saw that my mom, she fainted. She lay on the floor. And her body is so bloody. But she already died.
At the age of 9, Suzanne went to Ethiopia, where she worked for no pay, in the home of the friend who took her there. She then spent her adolescence as an unpaid servant in the homes of 2 other Somali families, one of whom eventually helped her get to Indonesia. Knowing nobody when she arrived, she eventually met a Somali businessman who arranged a ticket to Australia and a false passport.
I arrived in Sydney 8 in the morning, Monday. It was a dream. At the time I came even Australia, still my body is shaking. Even my hand. The time I give it to him, the immigration is, my hand is like shake. They never look me in my face. They never look me the passport. They never nothing. They make the stamp and they get it in. I take it, all my stuff. I go outside. At the time I went outside. I saw that a lot of people, they're walking here. I'm so crying, maybe 2 hours. For some way, I'm become so happy. In the other way, I'm so crying because I don't know where to go still. It was summer, but me, my body, it is so cold. I got the fever too much because I didn't wear it for jump or nothing. And at the time I finished the cry, I became red. And I said, where are you going now? You came to Australia. Okay, you gotta succeed. It's good. Where are you going now? And then I straight away and I got the Indian taxi driver. And then I asked him and I said, do you know where the Somali people live? Maybe you know something. He said, yeah, I know. The old Somali people, they are taxi driver. I know a few of people. If I didn't get, if we go to the mosque or La Kamba, maybe you get someone help you. And I said, I don't care. Whatever he is, I don't care. Just take me. Take me out in here.
The taxi driver took Suzanne to the Lakemba Mosque, where through various networks, she finally settled in Melbourne. She's currently studying English at TAFE and has just been given a temporary protection visa for 3 years.
Some adjustment oranges? How dark do you like it? Very, very dark. So we leave it to soak.
14 kilometres from Melbourne CBD is the multicultural suburb of Doncaster. It's where Reem Yunus, a Palestinian-Australian teacher, lives with her 2 daughters, Salma and Lamise.
Yep, my name is Lamise. I'm 21 and I'm a student at RMIT University.
My name's Salma, I'm 18 and I'm a student at Deakin University and we're both Reem's daughters.
How did you feel growing up in a household headed by a single woman?
It was pretty good. We were all girls, so it was really comfortable. We all understood each other. We were all in the same wavelength. Mum was great. She's trying to hold down a job and raise us at the same time, and I think it went pretty good.
So your mum's a role model for you?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Mums are always the role models for their daughters, but, yeah, in our case, I think, yeah, she was an exceptional person because, yeah, she did do a lot of things that usually, like, roles undertaken by two people, she did it, so... No, I definitely admire her for that. Yeah.
And despite it being frowned upon by the wider Arab community.
Did you have to battle a lot with that attitude from the community?
Not so much us, because we were young when it first happened, but
We cut out from the community. So I think it was easier on us because we didn't have to sit there and explain to everyone, because when my parents first got divorced, it was a very hot issue with a lot of the people from the community, and a lot of people were angered about it, even though it was none of their business. We didn't have to face that, which was actually pretty good now looking back on it. We only started getting back into the community like 5-6 years ago, so by then I don't think we had to face much issues, because I think divorce didn't become as much of an issue. Like, it happened a lot more often within the community, and people just generally got over it.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a sad part of my life. It was the time that I decided that my marriage wasn't working and I needed to leave. And in that time, a large number of the people in the community, they were very judgmental and they were harsh. They were interfering with me and with my kids. And at that time, I had enough on my plate to deal with, you know, dealing with a new situation, unmarried in a foreign country for the first time, having your marriage that lasted 13 years to collapse, and to admit to yourself that you have failed in something that you vowed that you want to make it work no matter what, but you couldn't. Yeah, so I had a lot on my plate to deal with, and I had to take the decision to isolate myself from them and isolate my kids from them and take some time off for soul searching and trying to empower myself. I'm sure everybody is aware that marriage, when it ends in divorce, you need to deal with a lot of layers of emotions, and it was very healthy for me to be either on my own or meet new people whom I choose myself, because I in my marriage I lost any sense of identity. I needed to be me and to find out who is me before getting in touch with people at all.
So what was your identity at the time? How connected did you feel to your Palestinian identity, to your Arab identity, and to your Muslim identity?
My own identity as an Arab and a Muslim and a Palestinian never has been shaken, even at the time. I just knew these people are the few who represent themselves only. To me, they represent the times, the years, the decades, the hundreds of years of weaknesses in our political and economical system as Arabs and Muslims. So there, as we all know, there are a lot of accumulation of foolish traditions and stupid interpretations of Islam and being an Arab and being a woman even. So I wasn't refusing my identity as an Arab or a Muslim or a Palestinian. I was rather protecting my kids from being exposed to the wrong ideas or interpretations of Islam, and seeking to find what is a good, empowered image for myself and for my daughters also to maybe want to follow.
So you were questioning the traditional interpretations of Islam?
I have been questioning the traditional interpretations of Islam all over my life. The irony, I always was reading, you know, about, you know, the women issues, the some feminist Arab women characters. I've always followed that. But never in my wildest dreams could see myself in the situation that I have been put through 10 years ago when I had to be faced with such stupidity, and I had to make my own body as a bridge for the other women, whether Arabs, Muslims, Australians, anybody, to use me as an example and follow that bridge into the other bank of that river, the bank of freedom, the bank of dignity. A woman needs and has the right to feel dignified, to feel respected for who she is, not to be enmeshed or oppressed or humiliated.
You're listening to Street Stories on ABC Radio National. Reem, Nazifa and Suzanne all did a leadership and empowerment course with the Islamic Women's Welfare Council of Victoria. Jumana El-Matrah developed the course.
It's not that the women we worked with are only Muslim. It's also that they're actually immigrant women, and there is a lot said about the role of an immigrant woman in a newly developing community in Australia. So we looked at what Islam says about women. We looked at what our notions of an immigrant woman is in Australia, what our collective notions of what women are in general. And we basically looked at the positives of these different dialogues, and we looked at the negatives of these different dialogues. One of the key issues that women have often struggled with is women's right to lead. The very traditional representations of Islam has been that leadership is the domain for men, and that needed to be shifted. And most women, most Muslim women, understood intuitively that the position was wrong, but they only felt it, and they didn't really have the material to justify their position. So we basically gave them the actual material to help them be able to support their own views. So the right of women to lead was something that women needed to basically have evidence for. The right of women to exist and be active beyond the home was also very important to them. Men and women being equal was also an issue that many Muslim women wanted addressed, because that has been a very controversial area within Islam.
Your boy hit you and you drink it. And also it's got very good history about Turkish coffee, because some people do know how to read the cup as well. They're going to read the cup about your lifestyle, you know, where you
Nazifa where is also studying at TAFE for the Diploma in Community Work. She says that after finishing the leadership course, she still had many more questions.
Why people using their wife or using their mother as a slave in their home, you know? Everybody got the right to live in this world. And also, everybody has an idea. They can present themselves. They can, you know, stand on their feet. They can look after themselves. No one can use other people for their needs, you know, like in the family. Husband always expect that the dishes must be ready, the house must be clean, the clothes must be being washed, and they also respect the wife always has to be in the house and shouldn't be allowed to go out before asking them or something like that. I am being asking this question, why? Why, you know? We are human, we got mind. How come they represent us like piece of clothes or something like that, you know? I'm asking that question, and also I find lots of the answers. So at the moment, I'm not give a chance to my husband or to other person that I have to expect that what they're saying.
So you're challenging?
family life. You're challenging people in your family who expect you to behave in a certain way. How is your husband, for example, reacting to your challenges?
He's not reacting anything. He's understand me. You know, at the beginning, he said, a woman shouldn't do this, woman shouldn't go there, woman shouldn't act like this or something like that. But now, when I explain him in a normal way, you know, he's not react like bad behavior or something like that. He said, you're right. When I involve in the community and also start studying, he's seeing that, you know, I'm doing good thing. He realized that now. So he's not saying anything. He shouldn't say anything.
You say you've learned to speak your mind and to speak up. When did that process start happening for you?
Starting from my early stages of thinking of separation and then divorce and all these things, I started to look down within myself to the times when I was strong and empowered, when I was at school and in my family. And then I used the help of everything possible in Australia, like, you know how you can get counseling and you can get to go into a lot of self-help courses. The thing that I liked the most and I worked on the most is building my self-confidence and self-esteem, but also working on my assertiveness skills that has been lost for years. I'm still working on it until now. So yes, speaking your mind is a very good skill that I was encouraged to do here a lot in Australia.
Well, the popular stereotype of a Muslim woman is that she's disempowered, pretty much a second-class citizen. What do you say to that stereotype?
It is a stereotype, thank you for the word. I remember one of the early courses I went to. In that course, there were eight other Australians who came from very abusive relationships. When it was time for my interview, they asked me what I want out of it, but one of the questions that stood out for me the most was, where do you come from? When I said where I come from, and they knew that I'm a Muslim, they looked at me rather naively and saying, perhaps this is the reason. And I felt very angry because I thought, well, they are meeting women every day from all sorts of backgrounds, and why with me should it be because of being a Muslim? And my spontaneous response at that time, I will just tell them, look, if this was the case, then I wouldn't have rebelled at all. I've never believed that a woman should be treated like rubbish. If I believed that, then I wouldn't have found that unusual and I wouldn't have rebelled. So how come do you say that?
It was 2003, and I caught for train, and I wanted to go my home, and then I saw her, the man, he looked like, I don't know, just the big tattoo. That is my first time to see, you know, the tattoo. And then he came straight away, and he said, hey, African woman, is ugly woman, you're disgusting woman. You know why? Because he told many things, but I never understand. You know what? I don't know English. If he tells something nice or if he tells something bad, like I'm like deaf. I can't understand nothing. Only I'm smiling. That's it. And then he go back to his seat. After a few minutes, he come back again. He said many things. I understand he's very angry. When I look his face, the old passenger, they look at me. The nobody said, hey, leave that woman, that lady, or whatever, nobody. And it feel a little bit scary. And I said, maybe he can hit you, maybe he do something. The third one, he's coming again, the man, and he said, fuck you, wherever you come from, fuck. He said maybe many times, fuck, fuck. The other man, he said, hey, are you crazy? Leave the lady. Why are you shouting? Shut up. And I saw many things, you know. Even if you walk the street, you get someone or some people, they say, hey, go back in your country. You are Muslim, fuck Muslims, fuck this one, fuck this one, that one. Maybe some people, they do something bad. But I'm not did nothing. Just I'm human, I'm living here. You know, I don't know.
How do you deal with this when it happens to you?
You know, the only one thing that you can do, that's it. If you make the ignorant or you never listen what he said, maybe you can walk straight away. They never say to you again because you are ignorant all the things he said to you. Yeah, maybe you can get the solution. If you say something, maybe they can hit you, you know.
What kinds of things are you prepared to tackle now that you may not have been willing to or able to tackle before?
Now, I feel myself I'm free. If I need to do something or if I need to meet some other people or other thing, I go straight away. Before, I wouldn't do this. I can't do this. I said, what if somebody say what this woman's doing here or something like that. Now I feel more comfortable and more free.
If we go back in my country, you know, all Somali women, they don't have any rights. They don't have any chance to go and to learning or to get a job, you know. The old men, they think the women, they are weak. Even in my religion, they didn't tell us the women, they are weak. Now, I can't tell them because I can tell, you know, the someone, if he did something wrong, I can said, you know, you are not right to do this one because she got the right way. She can do whatever she need, you know. But before, I didn't know until I learned or studied for this course, yep.
So you started to have a new understanding of Islam when you got to Australia.
Yeah. I saw many things.
Yeah. So you're feeling stronger.
It's stronger. It's very, very stronger than the man. Yeah.
And you are feeling stronger?
Oh, my God. Me too. Yeah, absolutely. I'm feeling big, strong. Yeah.
Till our dreams become reality.
There is a good future because there is a lot of empowerment programs everywhere. There are a lot of women organizations and Islamic women organizations. The people who come here, although they have their own programming, still have to cope with the reality that they have to change according to the changes of society. I'm seeing that happening slowly but surely. I know that Muslim women, in fact, have a lot of opportunities to become better Muslims than maybe if they grew over there back home.
Just me, it's free, even though I miss all my family, but still I'm free and I need to forget all of them. The day I remember, I need to pray Allah and to you know, yeah, feel peace and to forget all of the things that I, you know, that I got the problem. Yeah, inshallah, I will be doing many things. Yep. Still, I'm young, but I'm 23 years old, but inshallah, yep.
Thanks to the Islamic Women's Welfare Council of Victoria, Claudia Taranto, and Mark Don, I'm Nadia Stanny.